Good afternoon, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. Today is the 11th of December, and we have three stories for you here today, two of which I wrote, so this is effectively just a podcast about me. The best kind of podcast, I'm sure you'll agree, Michael.
Well, there will inevitably be...
I was really just looking for a quick yes there.
A level of commentary. But it's not about you, Gary, let's face it. It's about the minister and other ministers and the government and reports and fascinating things, but yes.
Are you implying that a journalist cannot be the story they're reporting on, or shouldn't be?
They can be. After that, I leave it up to the wisdom of the listener whether they should be.
Anyway, here are the stories. A new report came out. Effectively said, the secret to the success of the Irish transgender movement was keeping it under the radar, pinning it to more successful and more popular reforms, and ensuring that they didn't get what they refer to as excessive media coverage of their activities.
Yeah, excessive, I like that.
Yeah, that's a good phrasing. Then we want to talk about a new piece of research that was put out by the Irish Heart Foundation and the Irish Cancer Society. It is about vaping. It is about flavouring in vaping. It is total and absolute garbage. So we are just going to rip it apart. And in doing so, also ask some questions of the Irish Heart Foundation and the Irish Cancer Society.
As in, lads, what are ye at?
And then finally, we have the news, the shocking, shocking news, that Fianna Fáil will back the Sinn Féin legislation that would implement a statewide rent freeze. Are you shocked, Michael?
That Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin should engage in what appears like a form of auction politics a couple of months before an election?
No, strangely enough, no, Michael. I mean, are you shocked that Fianna Fáil would back something they absolutely know doesn't work, but which they also know will be deeply popular?
I'm not shocked, but maybe I'm a little sad.
Aww.
Yes, every day, the little optimist, the little idealist inside me dies another death. But there you go.
I'm shocked you were able to keep that going past the first campaign you helped run for Fianna Fáil.
Youth is a great thing, Gary. There's always the possibility next year it'll get better. But when you've got it, when you've said next year it'll get better for 30 years, you start to suspect that next year is going to be exactly the same as this year.
Depends what you measure by better.
Well, indeed. Anyway,
the report.
Yes, I came across this in an article in The Spectator, but written by James Girkup, is it? Like, I don't want to get the man's name wrong. Basically, outlining what he describes as the strategy and the tactics of the transgender movement globally, actually, and how they've achieved their successes. But we get quite a number of little mentions and hat tips in the article.
We do. So this is an interesting report. It was called Only Adults, Good Practices and Legal Gender Recognition for Youth. It was put together by IGLYO, which is an international LGBT lobby group, the Thomas Reuters Foundation, which is the corporate foundation of the Reuters news company, and a law firm called Dentons, which is meant to be the largest law firm in the world. They had help in Ireland with a solicitors group, and also Belong To, which is an LGBT plus advocacy group, who received €638,097 in government grants in 2018.
Which is not small money.
No, but the report was, this is not someone who is against the movement. This is very much people who are supportive, and what they were doing was they were looking at various countries, how they had successes, basically to educate activists in other countries to replicate those successes.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a weird report in certain ways.
It is, but it's a very good report for the point of view of someone trying to understand the processes and the strategies, because it's written by lawyers in this very clear, sensible kind of way, saying, okay, this has worked, this is a problem. I think he makes the point, Kirkup makes the point in the article, that Dentons don't themselves necessarily take a position on the issue, but rather that they were commissioned to write this, or to help to write this, on the basis of the experience, to take all of the information, the evidence that it was available up to now on campaigns, to make a précis of it and then to analyse what had been what had worked, what had not, what was useful, what was less useful.
Now, it does look like they did it pro bono.
I don't. That may be the case. I don't know what the policies that Dentons have. Maybe they do one for transgender rights, and maybe next week they'll do something for Posy Parker, you know, as a balancing thing. I have no idea, but yeah, pro bono, it might give you a pause to thought, but I don't know for a fact, so I can't. But they've done it very well. It's very clear.
It is clear. At the same time, you can still tell that this was written by consultants. So there's a great deal of euphemism and careful phrasing.
Yes.
But it is actually surprisingly blunt. Now, I did read the Spectator piece. It was James Kirkup. He took a different line on it than we did in Ireland. His line was mostly about parental consent.
Yes.
Because a big thing of the report is arguing that, the report doesn't argue. It puts forward recommendations.
It observes.
From other people.
The quote, he says, it is recognised, this is the quote from the report, it is recognised that the requirement for parental consent or the consent of a legal guardian can be restrictive and problematic for minors.
Now, he did, but I was interested that he didn't use a further quote, which I found actually more kind of interesting, and it was this: states should take action against parents who are obstructing in refusing to give parental authorization when required.
Yeah, what they say, it's a full quote, that who are obstructing the free development of a young trans person's identity in refusing to give the parental authorization required. So that's really, states should take action against parents. Now, it's hard to unpack that without having some sense that this is talking about a punitive approach to parents. Some kind of sanction is being contemplated here, because otherwise I don't see what sense this sentence makes.
I find it's just a bizarre thing, because you have this move towards kind of affirmative treatment of transgender children, which is where the clinician will just agree with you if you say that if you feel like you're another gender. They'll just tell you, well, of course you are. If they don't take that stance, some countries...
Well, the American Psychiatric Association have said that if you do not, if the therapist cannot immediately affirm his client or her client, his or her client, in their gender choice, then they have no business being the therapist to the client.
Which will be fantastic when we bring in state sanctions against parents, because it'll go to court and the court will go, well, this psychologist or this psychiatrist says your child is transgender, without mentioning that the overarching body which oversees them has said if they don't, they have no place being that child's psychologist or a psychiatrist. And that won't create any sort of weird scenarios, clearly.
Yeah, and it's all of this is a bit, I mean, we have known for a long time that people presenting with transgender identity issues tend to, but proportionately have large numbers of other comorbidities that really should be considered when you're going to take a proper, careful, holistic, psychiatric or psychological approach towards a person. You shouldn't just consider one thing and just ignore all of this other rich personal detail around you, which is part of your personal, your professional competence also.
I mean, there's the parental guide stuff and there's the transgender issue generally, which we've gone through before on the show. But in relation to stuff that's new and that's in the report, which is more about the techniques and strategies of transgender groups, when it's talking about Ireland, what it actually says is, the most important lesson from the Irish experience is arguably that trans advocates could possibly be much more strategic by trying to pass legislation under the radar, by latching trans right legislation onto more popular legal reforms such as marriage equality.
Yes.
I also found it particularly interesting that, I mean, this thing is, it seems that Reuters were the people, or the Thomas Reuters Foundation are the people really behind this, helping put it together. Primarily. But the report says things like, another technique which has been used to great effect is the limitation of press coverage and exposure.
Yeah.
And they repeatedly have that trend that you should stay away from the press, you should go to lobbyists, and they put forward Ireland as an example of where this was well done.
Yeah.
And you should keep it out of the press. But Reuters is a news organization. So why is a news organization driving a report which is saying keep things away from news organizations?
And the language that he uses is explicitly about obfuscation and cover-up. When he refers to the experience in Ireland, Denmark and Norway regarding linking this issue with the marriage equality, he says the marriage equality legislation provided a veil of protection, particularly in Ireland, where marriage equality was strongly supported, but gender identity remained a more difficult issue to win public support for. Now, a group of people are involved in, or a company dedicated to news reporting. That's an odd thing, a veil of protection. In other words, you're hiding it away, you're keeping it covered up, you're distracting, it's a bit like you're the old misdirection from a magician. Don't look over there, look over here. You like this, don't you? Don't worry about that.
One of the things I do know is when it talks about the media and it will say things like, you know, incorrect narratives may take hold, the public may misunderstand. And it did strike me as, you know, the thing you see certain progressives will do where if you disagree with them, they'll say you're ignorant and you need to educate yourself. Yeah. And because they say you're ignorant and you're uneducated, they don't actually have to deal with what you just said.
Yes.
Because it's not worth consideration. So it's a way to just negate someone's view, where oftentimes what I think they mean is, it's not that you have misunderstood us, it's that you disagree with us. And that's the kind of sense I get here of, they're not worried that the public will misunderstand them, or the public will have a negative and pernicious narrative, as they say. They're worried the public will disagree.
Technique of non-engagement is fairly typical. I can remember Jonathan Haidt talking about an incident where a well-known liberal journalist with the New York Times, very well-established journalist with the New York Times, a columnist, had written an article basically saying, you know, something has fundamentally happened here. We used to be able to talk about it in a nuanced way about immigration. And he quoted people like Paul Krugman, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, all making statements about immigration in this qualified way, saying good this, bad that, this is positive, but that this could be negative. And he's saying, what's happened? And the response was horrendous. But he said, as he read response after response after response, he recognised that nobody actually was engaging him in an argument. It was just, basically, the response was of insult and rejection. Nobody was actually, because they didn't, like you said, you're ignorant. Get yourself educated, or check your privilege, or forgot, whatever it is. People felt somehow they gave themselves permission not to have to bother to actually engage with the argument. It's like a priori, it's axiomatic that whatever, if you say X, Y, or Z, well, that is axiomatically wrong. It's clear. It's a priori. It's wrong. So you don't actually have to engage with it at all. Now, it's quite an effective way to do it if you can do it confidently and look into the camera when you're doing it and smile and sound serious. People can be caught. You have to be able to, you need somebody pretty sharp and good on the other end of it to unpack it.
I mean, if you do it well and you hide what you're doing and you latch it on to more important stories, yeah, so that people, particularly the media, don't notice it, and then it's just changed. And no one can really complain because it could be years down the road and they go, wait, we do what now? Like, oh yeah, since 2015 or whenever. Now, it is also worth noting that the report says that Irish activists view the 2015 Gender Recognition Act not as a victory, but as a starting point for future action.
Well, we know that the legislation has been under review. We also know that, I don't know now, but the review was taking place in camera and unreported, because it felt, for some reason, it was felt that it would not be possible to do this in a public forum. He talks about the use of, which is, I think, very interesting, that you get ahead of the agenda You get ahead of the government's agenda. You anticipate where the government might be going. And what trans lobbies have been very good at doing is setting themselves up as the consultative grouping, so that when the government gets around to doing it, that they're the people that they go to.
Oh, yes, they're the unbiased advocacy group that you want to go to for the facts. But anyway, if people are interested in that, there's an article on it called Keeping Lobbying Under the Radar is Key to Our Success, Irish Trans Lobby Ungripped. That has some quotes and a link to the full report in it. And if you're interested, the entire report, it's about 65 pages long. And it's actually legitimately quite interesting. But on to the Irish Cancer Society and the Irish Heart Foundation.
Yes.
Because this was a shit show. They launched new research this week. It was fronted by Minister Simon Harris.
Aha, the great Simon, all hail.
He, in fact, said he had been absolutely convinced by the research. And he stood there on camera in Buzzwells, I believe, because if there's one building in this country I can recognise the meeting rooms of, it's Buzzwells. And he said that the bill that was going forward, that he would now be seeking restrictions on advertisement of e-cigarettes, basically yeah. In the same vein as what they did with alcohol. And then he turns to the table and goes, and I haven't quite figured out how to do this legally yet, but we're going to do something about flavourings. Like, 1 year on camera, and it's not a great look for a minister to say, well, we're not sure if we can do this legally yet. We're going to do it anyway. Basically, the research they put out, they said that the vaping industry is lying about flavoured vape, and those flavours are aimed at children. They're not aimed at adults. And, you know, here is the proof. We have it. It's blown this thing wide open. As Simon Harris said, the industry has to know we're onto them. They're taking us for fools. Which, considering he found this evidence compelling, is not going to say terribly inaccurate, if that was their assumption. But what I looked into the methodology of this report, because this is an area that the Edinburgh Institute has done some stuff on. We've done briefing papers on it. And we were unaware of any kind of research on this. But we were also aware that the HSE, in their State of Tobacco Control in Ireland report, which of 2018, said that 0% of non-smokers vape.
0%. So there was a little bit of smokers vape.
0%. So there was a little bit of, if they're saying they've proved this, must be a massive uptick in youth vaping that was going, no one had found it, and they've, they've dug, this.
The accusation here, explicit or implicit, is that vaping industry is not simply aiming itself at adult smokers who are trying to give up, but also at people who have never smoked and at children in order to get them hooked on their product.
No, they explicitly said that this research has revealed that e-cigarette companies are not telling the truth. So I looked into this. I dug into it. Now, I had put aside a certain amount of time to dig into it, and let me tell you, it did not take that period of time. Because what I found when I looked at it is, it's just garbage. It's garbage to a degree I legitimately didn't think an Irish NGO would even have the gall to publish it. I don't have a high opinion of the standard of research produced by most Irish NGOs. I think most of them are bad. They're just badly put together. Like the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, who recently released a report saying that there is no international evidence that body cameras on police are good for either police or citizens, which is nonsense. However, they at least did an evidence review. What happened with these guys is they got 16 children in Dublin. They split them into groups of four. They brought them in for 40 minutes. They had them arrange pictures of e-cigarette packaging on a continuum of most likely to appeal to a child, most likely to appeal to an adult. And then they asked them for a response to four statements. And that was it. They asked 16 children what they thought about this over a 14-minute play session and chat. And that gave them enough to launch a report, call for legislative change, convince the Minister for Health they were correct.
Am I right in my memory that the Minister used the word compelling?
You know, Michael, I'm not sure. He definitely said he was convinced by it.
I may be misremembering, but I think when I was watching it, or I was reading the pressers, that the evidence was compelling. No, I may be misremembering. But Gary, when you described this to me first, I genuinely thought...
You thought I was fucking with you to get you angry.
I didn't discount that possibility because you are a sick and twisted man. But I did think that you had maybe missed the addendum or the appendix or the next bit of the report or something. Because I couldn't believe that you take 16 kids from the same town, from the same socioeconomic group, split them into four groups, basically a kind of a substandard focus group, ask them a set of leading questions, none of which are demonstrative of anything. None of them. None of these things demonstrate anything. And then at the end of it, say, this shows X, Y, or Z. I don't know. And then you sent me the report and I read it and I thought, well, you know the response I gave you on my email. I won't say it. I won't repeat it here because I've been getting some negative comments on my occasional outbursts at my bad language. But the fact that this could be considered convincing. Now, around a year ago, I think I said to you and I said to our colleague Paddy in the EBI that I had noticed reading the international press, looking at the English papers, American papers, there seemed to be a rather sudden upsurge in anti-vaping activity. There was a lot of stuff, more than a year ago, there was a rather very severe statement coming out of a UN conference in Copenhagen, very anti-vaping, and there was stuff coming out in Ireland and stuff in America, and I thought, where's this coming? Has there been some new evidence? No, to be very clear, as you said, the EBI has no, and we make it clear, we have no position on the issue of vaping.
No, we followed the research, and if new research comes out that kind of goes, there's been a terrible mistake, we'll change our position. Now, I think at this point there's enough research we can say that's not going
to
happen.
What we're interested in, I suppose, are two things fundamentally. One is, we are innocent advocates of a thing called evidence-based policy making rather than policy-based evidence making. And we think if you want to do something, you should follow the evidence. If there's evidence for something, pay attention to that. Second thing is that we should not spend our lives in the pursuit of some kind of utopian perfection, but rather live in the real world and say, what is the option that will create the best benefit for the biggest benefit for people, the largest reduction in harm, and also, and this is something I know you're interested in, Gary, in the vaping issues, the biggest financial return or saving to people, because we know that, say, for 40% of smokers are unemployed. So if you can get them to give up smoking or to reduce, to go to vaping, you know, you're talking about very serious income saving for the poorest people in the country. As it stands, we're not advocating anything. We're just saying, lads, I don't vape. Gary doesn't vape. Neither of us have shares in vaping companies or tobacco companies. Well, I don't anyway, Gary. Do you?
Not that I know of.
But lads, this is nonsense. Now, and just to observe, what is the position, Gary, off the top of your head, on from Cancer UK on vaping?
That vaping is one of the most effective harm reduction options available to smokers.
And
basically, if you look at the British, like Public Health England, Cancer UK, or Cancer Research UK, any of those groups, they all have a basic line, which is this: if you smoke, vape. If you don't smoke,
don't vape. Perfectly sensible.
And that's about it. And in fact, the Irish NGOs have been saying for years at this point, you know, there's not enough evidence. We're waiting for the evidence to come in while making no effort to create that evidence on their own. And I think most people would have believed them. But look, the point I make in the article is anyone, and both of these organizations, by the way, have budgets of over 10 million a year. They have the money to do good research on this. I suspect they didn't do good research because they know the results of good research.
But why would they?
into this area.
They are, I'm sure, well-intentioned people, passionate about improving the condition of the people for whom they do this research, people with heart disease, people with cancer. I'm sure they are well-intentioned and they're well-meaning. Why they would ignore the position of, say, groups like Cancer UK or, say, Public Health England, Public Health England,
or ASH UK,
which is one of the earliest and most formidable anti-smoking lobby groups in the world.
It was incredible when they came out in support of vaping, because ASH have been relentlessly against smoking
and anything connected with any tobacco company as well. If you were, same as shopping with the devil.
I think the real difference between the English and the Irish NGOs is the English NGOs actually care about research.
I tell you,
so they saw this came out, and then they did research into it.
Could talk about caring about research. Well, let's talk about caring about now. Another failure here has been the reportage on the subject. Now, okay, this has only just come out today, so we'll give the press a couple of days to go over it, and we'll see if somebody does come out and say, you know what, lads, as a piece of research, this is pretty damn poor. Frankly, the piece of research that this was, a journalist could have read it in 5 to 10 minutes and recognised that it wasn't exactly a piece of wonder research. But if you look at what has happened already in the Irish press, like, you remember, Gary, there was a number of cases, many cases across the United States of people who were reported with severe respiratory illness and in some cases of death, which were connected to vaping. And that story was reported across the Irish media. However, what wasn't reported but was reported in the same stories in the United States, and I'm talking about, say, the New York Times. I'm not talking about mad right-wing crazy people. I'm talking about, you know, the voice of liberal reasonableness. They also pointed out that there was a very strong reason to believe that these were actually connected with off-brand uses from people who were fiddling with the technology to use in order not to smoke regular nicotine-based substance, but oils containing THC, which is the psychoactive element of cannabis. And in fact, it turned out when the Center for Disease Control, the CDC of the United States, made its report, its report said that these cases were all connected to the use of non-proprietary technologies, fiddling around with the burners and using THC, which hasn't happened in England, Ireland, or the United States. No, that wasn't reported. That's an important part of that story.
This report managed to get news, probably because Minister Harris launched it, and I think reporters will, in general, if they've looked into this, realise that this was not what they were sold, and so there is a possibility that this will hurt the Irish Cancer Society and the Irish Heart Foundation, because if you were sent like a press release on this, you took their word, you published it, and then you see the actual research, well, that's a whole other thing. One thing I did know is Paul Cullen, who is the health editor of the Irish Times, he wrote about this, and he wrote about how this was based on focus group testing with third and fourth year students. Would you like to know what he didn't mention, Michael?
What didn't he mention?
That there were 16 of them. So this goes from absolutely unrepresentative research, which in no way could give us anything of statistical significance because the numbers are too small, to simply...
And no comparative. It was done... No comparative group with adults either to see if there was any difference.
No,
there's a million things wrong with this. It's not research at all, anyway. But
he talks... There's four paragraphs on the focus group component of this. And he doesn't mention the number of people. He doesn't mention the thing which most damages this study. And I can't see that being accidental.
Do you know what this reminds me of? And when I read it, it reminded me immediately. Back in the day, before the marriage referendum, there were 50 articles or 50 pieces of research had been done on the outcomes of family formation, depending on different types of family formation, non-standard family formation, and looking specifically at the issue of same-sex families, right, and children's. Mm. And when you actually went through the report, some of the quality of some of them was just brutal. And one of them was based on self-reporting from 4 or 5 lesbian mothers in South California. And that was a study. They filled in a self-report about how they thought their children were doing really well and sent it off. And five lesbian mothers in South California represented research. Well, we're at the similar kind of quality here, and it's about as convincing. But we'll see. I'm fingers crossed that we're going to see some journalists and columnists. I mean, maybe a couple of economists or somebody, people who understand things about methodology and statistics and such like, might get hold of this and start to do a bit of a job on it. I won't hold my breath, but I will live in hope.
Now, to close, as I wrote an article on that as well, if you want to read it, it's on Gripped, and it's titled "The Latest Anti-Vaping Research is a Bad Joke," and it pretty much just goes through the methodology of it. So, to close, Michael, a story that doesn't involve me in any way. Fianna Fáil backing legislation to implement statewide rent caps.
Yeah, as you say, shock horror that Fianna Fáil should go down this line. Kind of surprising, if nothing else, that they decided to what seems like fairly uncompromising support of a piece of legislation designed by Sinn Féin, rather than coming up with their own parallel piece and pretend, you know, basically saying the same thing but pretending that it was somehow different. The particular piece is that they are going to freeze rents across the board, across the country, statewide, for 3 years, the next 3 years. They will give renters an annual tax credit of €1,500 for the next 3 years. Now, as the Hugh O'Connell reports, the opposition from the government may seek to use the money message to block the bill becoming law. They may decide it's a money bill, and that will make it much more difficult for it to become law. But as it stands, I imagine will this. I suppose it'll be this. People will. This will be popular. But as bad ideas go, is there an idea in economics, Gary, you would say has more general agreement about it, other than rent control is a bad thing, that is more widely agreed on? Amongst economists left and right, there is pretty well, I wouldn't say unanimity, there is never unanimity, but you're up in the 90% kind of thing of economists who will say rent controls not only do not achieve what they set out to achieve, as in the idea that somehow you're going to make it easier for people to get apartments or housing, but they have a whole series of downstream effects which are bad news, and especially bad news for poorer people.
No, it's pretty up there.
I can't remember. I the name in my head is Gunnar Myrdal. I may be wrong. Who was a left-wing Swedish economist in the 50s. Who was responsible, I think it was Gunnar Myrdal, was responsible for a famous quote, which he said that other than carpet bombing, no policy is as effective as rent control for the destruction of cities, which is, you know, kind of, I lived in a city which had rent control. When I went to live in Milan, you had a thing called equo canone, and you were told how much you could charge per square meter, and it depended what part of the city you were from, I think, in the level of service and the finish and whatever. And it was horribly difficult for anybody to get an apartment in Milan. And in fact, you saw a flight from the city in that period where people went to suburbs outside where new towns had been built by Berlusconi and his friends. Because the rules did not apply there. Equo canone was abolished, and do you know what miraculously happened, Gary? Nobody could have predicted this. A year later, everybody said, my God, it's much easier to get an apartment. And the price of apartments actually fell. The rents fell. It was easier for me as a foreigner to get an apartment than it was from someone who was from Milan, because there always are in these laws, there are always little get-outs and caveats and little cul-de-sacs and rat runs. And one of them was that if you are what they called uso forestieri, which was for the use of a non-resident or a non-Milanese person, you could charge a going rate for rent. So for someone like me, as a foreigner, I could actually find it easy find a flat more easily. You look at New York. You look at San Francisco today. Will have a temporary, a short-lived temporary respite when you introduce these things first. But very, very quickly, the whole thing starts to go very, very badly wrong.
You'll slow it down, and then people will go, oh, this is working fantastically. And then the market will start to rapidly destabilize, and everything will go to the wall.
You'll find also that one of the unintended consequences, and this is something that repeats itself, is that these laws tend end up being very good for middle-class people. Because they will get into apartments and they will hand them on tenancy after tenancy, and people also will stay in larger apartments. So, for example, if you have a large apartment or a large house and you stay and you're renting it, rather than downsizing when your circumstances change, you stay in it because it's rent controlled. The quality and the maintenance, this again has been testified to. It's not an opinion. It's been repeated again and again. But the quality of the maintenance of the apartments declines because apartment.
Why are you going to spend money on something you're not making that much money on?
And because usually in these cases, if they leave it, there are mechanisms by which you can get out of them because they're usually in some way time based. You very often find that people will let apartments sit empty for periods of time, in order that they, after a certain amount of time, then they can put them back onto the market. Or they simply sell them, or they go into a condominium, and then you further reduce. And that's what happened in Milan. Apartments that had been rental buildings, like the building I was in had been built in the late, I think in the 1890s, and had been rented by a mix of sort of skilled artisans, professionals, that kind. It was a mixed area, nice area. And they went into condo because the rents became too low.
We've talked about rent caps before, why they don't work, that sort of stuff. I think it is worth noting that Fianna Fáil's housing spokesman is Dara O'Brien, who is far too informed and far too smart to think that this is going to work. What do you think do they think the government is going to block this with a money message? And then it can lay some pretext for an election.
I think if you're going to be very, very cynical, I would say that they believe either it's going to be blocked because as a money bill, money message, or that very, very quickly. Now, I would be sceptical about the possibility that the bill would be referred by the president. I think if we had a different president, possibly. You have to remember, if you're too young to remember, and I should be too young to remember, but Supreme Court back in the early 80s, under O'Higgins, struck down what had been previously considered to be reasonable social rent controls. The government then rejigged the law in what was called the Housing Bill, 1981 Housing Bill, in order to gradually phase out rent controls. And the idea was that the district court would be allowed over a period, I think it was around 5 years, to introduce or to set the rates of rents. That was then appealed. And it was found to be also unconstitutional. Irish constitution, as it has been interpreted over the last 50 or 60 years, earlier than that, not so much, but since the 60s, has very strong, or what they call double protections for private property. So I could see somebody taking a constitutional case to this if it isn't referred to the court directly by the president. And I think that it would be a very reasonable thing to do on the basis of the history of the law here. So that the fact is that this may be struck down by the Supreme Court before it ever really got into action anyway. But the Fianna Fáil would score the brownie points of having shown how much they care.
Fianna Fáil brings it forward, the government blocks it. Fianna Fáil either use it as a pretext for an election, or they do something like No Confidence Harris and bring down the government using him. It's a national scandal either way that they're acting to save the country from. Then when they get in, well, of course, we're not going to bring in rent caps because we're going to build.
We're going to build.
Or, you know, maybe we will bring in rent caps for a 1 year period while we build.
We're going to build cities all across Dublin Bay, underneath Dublin Bay, in fact. Cities under the sea. It's going to be fantastic.
Where's that man who wanted to fill in Dublin Bay and build on it? Get him in here.
There was a fantastic plan where you're going to have a motorway which was going to go across the bay, swing across the bay, so Sandy Mount over across the Liffey and across the other side, and then it was going to be polarised underneath it. It would have been terrific. I love that. You know, the idea of this wonderful, sort of somewhere between a high road and a bridge across the bay. It would have been absolutely terrific. But you're saying that you think, ultimately your point must be that you think that Fianna Fáil have the itch on for an early election.
I think an election is clearly coming at some point. But as I said, Dara O'Brien is one of the sharper of the Fianna Fáil guys. Like, he's not an idiot. And he's not ill-read on this subject either. He strikes me as the kind of guy who, when you give him a brief, just reads about that brief and just gets into it. I don't think there's any way he thinks this would work. You'll have to say he thinks it will work.
We'll see. We will see. We will wait and see. Tomorrow is going to be very exciting. We have the British vote coming up, so we'll have to... the next time we're on, I suppose, we'll be chatting about that.
Tiny British flags for all.
Union Jacks for... Well, for some. Small tricolours for others. Or Scottish flags.
No tricolours, just Scottish flags, and we'll say we try.
And, that'll be Sunday, if we don't sort of break into the airways before that, in our state of excitement.
I was considering doing some sort of live stream of the results or something, but then I thought, would Sky do that?
Yeah, and BBC, and ITV, and Channel 4.
And they're better at it.
Yeah, and they get paid more, so let them do it.
By which I mean they get paid. We subsist purely on the joy of having you like and share our content on social media.
We thrive on the goodwill. And on that goodwill, we will rely and say for the time being till Sunday, our weekly miscellany, I'm going to say goodbye, good luck, and have a good weekend.
Have you just renamed the Sunday show?
God.
This is why I don't let you do the introduction, because you say, welcome to the conversation, and it's like you're trying to force a different name on
welcome
the show.
Welcome back to the conversation.
Oh, I see. You phrase it as if the conversation is the show, and you're just renaming things willy-nilly.
I like a nod to the notice, to the notion that we are just engaged in a conversation with our dear listener. And we have been away, and now we're back having another conversation.
I imagine this is the same style of conversation a kidnapper has with one of their victims.
I like to think that this is a form of Stockholm Syndrome, yes.
Not going to go into that.
Okay.
All the best.
Bye-bye.